So for our next storyteller, we have Jackie. She says that a polite term for her resume is diverse. So I think we can probably all relate. Over the years, she's answered to many titles: commercial fisherwoman, artist, writer, nurse, gardening entrepreneur, and, hey lady, that was a red light! Currently, she's pouring, mixing, and simmering all her passions into one delectable cookbook. Other days, she goes fishing, so, you know, I think. You can visit her at her newly launched site on Facebook, Cooking on the Wild Side. That sounds good. Or wildcook.blog. So welcome to the wild and fabulous Jackie.
Welcome. Come on in. You can have a seat. We can talk a while. Seems like kitchen talking is the best kind of talking there is. Here can be found a moment to slow down. Then we'll get to the business of cooking. Coffee? Tea? Kombucha? Sorry, we don't have cable, and cell phone doesn't work very well at our house either. So you might have to be careful at our house. Someone might start to fry something in caribou lard, or just start talking about whatever's on their mind. It's terrifying. Speaking of movies, I do love me the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding. Mine, an unbreakable bond. Big, there is always enough. Fat in the best kind of ways. Warm, luscious, full. Lamb on a barbecue. Salt, smoke, garlic, rosemary. My big fat Greek. Greek, geek. It doesn't really matter. It's all about being part of a group where you're welcomed, where you welcome others. A part of a group where you can get together and dance the Calamatino and shout, Opa! Wedding, that is all about the celebration. Weddings, births, birthdays, anniversaries, holidays, Saturdays. Saturday at 6, be there. There will be lots and lots of food. As an only and adopted child who hails from the land of socially stoic lutefisk eaters, that movie speaks to me like that fat on the barbecue. It speaks of family and friends and laughter. That is until the cousins get a hold of a bad idea or a chicken. I may be an only adopted child, but I'm only adopted on my paternal side. I had very close ties with my maternal side of the family. My great-grandmother was one of 19 children. She was a genealogical force of nature that glued us together like cream of mushroom soup glues a casserole together. It was amazing. She could just see anybody, and she'd start talking to them, and pretty soon they'd find something in common. In fact, we were probably related. Therefore, the chances of me finding someone to marry outside of my gene pool somewhere between the Midwest and Northern Europe was really grim. Then my dad said, guess what? Right before high school, he said, we're moving north to Alaska. Great, Juneau, cold, confined, and who knew it could rain sideways for a month? Kind of like here. I didn't know how to do this. How are we gonna have Thanksgiving without a crowd? How do you holiday without family? I could not comprehend it. The answer came in a big black garbage bag that moved. King crab. Turns out the neighbor was a fisherman. He wondered if my mom could cook it up, and could he bring a few of his buddies and some of their girlfriends too? They'd all bring something. Stories of Sitka black-tailed deer hunting. Chilling bear stories, and how to make a really good blueberry pie. Those stories flowed like that salmonberry wine, which was pretty good. I wasn't supposed to probably have any at that point, but anyway, if you've lived in Alaska long enough, you know that's true. You can go almost anywhere. And in a community like this, if you don't know someone directly, chances are after you visit for a while, you'll find out that you're connected somehow. And if you're not, you probably will be pretty soon. Kind of like that time some friends said, you should meet this really cute fisherman. Before I could say I do, Grandma Nibs adopted us and she offered to make the wedding cake. Friends brought shrimp and salmon quiche and it was amazing. There were births and birthdays, holidays, anniversaries. So the next time we moved north, it was no surprise to find out that new friends would become old friends and then eventually be promoted to next of kin. My littles grew up and they had littles of their own. Now we're a big crowd around the table. I'm trying not to. And so my youngest son, you know, for him, his friends are his cousins. And when a brood of unruly, noisy, smelly boys, when they storm my kitchen, I am blessed. So it looks like we're almost out of time. I promised I'd tell you a little bit about cooking, so I will. Friends and family and food aren't necessarily a recipe for disaster. Actually, friends and family are the secret ingredient. Food is just the bonus. We can all have a big, fat, Greek, messy, loud, crazy family. All we have to do is welcome someone. So open up your table, welcome someone into your life. And you're also welcome at our house. If you happen to be dropping by the store on the way, you could bring beer or salmonberry wine. That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. And I know you would not know this, but that was Jackie's first time telling a story with us. We've actually had a couple of first-timers up here tonight, and we appreciate all of them. It is nerve-wracking to get up and do this, and they've all just done a phenomenal job, which is evidence that the rest of you in this room, if you have not done this before, could do it. So our next opportunity is going to be December 8th, right here at Odie's, again at 6 o'clock. And the theme is, since it is December, Lighten Up, Stories of Escaping the Dark. And as always, you can take that theme however you want in whatever direction you want. So just to plant that seed, December 8th, be thinking about it. We always do a rehearsal beforehand, so we're happy to give feedback and work with folks. So hopefully our newbies this time can attest to the fact that they survived. And it is not the worst thing that has ever happened to them, I hope. All right, we've got a couple more tonight. Next up is Elizabeth Earle. Elizabeth lives in Kenai and has for the last 2 years writing for the Clarion. Before that, she lived and worked in Chicago after fleeing a Kenai-like town in northern Arizona.
I told myself that the first time I saw Cowboy, I was going to fall in love with him. It seemed like a perfect fit to me. I was 12, he was 15. I had been in love with horses my whole life and he was a horse. So it seemed to me like it was gonna go really well. Little did I know that as my father hands me this lead rope with a huge horse on the end of it, it would be the meanest animal I had ever met in my entire life and to this day still is. If you've ever been around a horse, you know that they look gentle for about a second. And then you realize this animal weighs 1,600 pounds. I weigh 100. That ratio works. He was a paint horse that had a big black mane and a genetic anomaly called glass eyes, meaning he had these bulbous blue eyes with deep black pits that were his pupils, and he would turn his head and look at you and do this kind of thing where he looked like he was smiling, but was really a prelude to biting you. And you didn't know this until he bit you. And there were many times that I'm like, okay, he's not gonna bite me this time. He was gonna bite me. He was gonna bite me every time. I should have known that. He also had a habit of every time you came within spitting distance of him to headbutt you. And this works when he's 1,600 pounds and you're 12. Simultaneously, my father also handed off a red lead rope to my sister, to the most docile, wonderful animal you've ever met, who was also a horse, named Sox. Cowboy and Sox we had bought together in a package because I, my whole life, had wanted a horse. Lots of little girls dream about horses, and we had moved to northern Arizona just in time for us to find a paddock and a corral and a place for us to do the ultimate thing that my sister and I had dreamed our whole lives of doing, of reading Black Beauty and reading horse anatomy books, to go for a trail ride away from the corrals. And so we got these horses, and I was 12, and I was ready. The horses were not. And we got our gear, and Cowboy had mysterious number of habits that made him really bad for riding. If you've ever saddled a horse, you know the trick that they use, because you have to put this thing called a girth strap on them, where you run it under their belly and you make it tight so that you can saddle up. Cowboy had figured this out, because horses don't like tight things around their belly, like most people. And so what they do is they take a deep breath and hold it while you're tightening this girth strap. And then you tighten and you're like, yeah. And then they let it go, and the girth strap is not that tight. And you get into the stirrup, and suddenly you're horizontal. And they're like, ha ha, you gotta try again. And you do this 3 or 4 times, and you realize you're not going for a ride today because it's 4 o'clock now. Similarly, Sox was wonderful at this. You could get the girth strap on him in 30 seconds. And my sister and I went for rides together, and she'd be riding for about twice as long as I would. But I was determined. So I learned that I needed to get a bridle on Cowboy myself. Little did I know that, you know, watching Sox wouldn't give me any sort of model for this, because he would take a bit, and you have to slide the bit into the horse's mouth to get control on them. You have to get it behind their ears. Sox did fine. Not only would Cowboy not take a normal joint bit, nor a grazing bit, which is a piece of metal about this long and this thick, he had to take a rubber grazing bit, which is about a piece of metal about this long and this thick and this wide. And you have to, in order to get a bit in their mouth, you have to get their teeth open. As I explained before, Cowboy liked to bite. And as I explained before, he also liked to headbutt. His favorite thing was to headbutt, bite, and put his hoof on my foot. I quickly got steel-toed boots, and I quickly got a pair of gloves, because what I had to do was take my thumb and stick it in the corner of his mouth and kick him in the front, and eventually he would say, bleh, and I would get the bit in his mouth and get the loop behind his ears, and he would headbutt me, and I would headbutt him back, and then we would go for a ride, a very stiff, angry ride, but a ride nonetheless. So I would mount up, and we would head out into the corral for practice, because I wanted to go on that trail ride. That was my goal. And we did this pretty steadily for about a year. I was homeschooled at the time, and then I started going to another general school, so we'd do it in the afternoons, and I was ready. We were getting ready. And then on one of the final training rides before we were going to go out for this trail ride, my sister and I pack up and go to bed for the evening. We were getting ready. And then in the middle of the night, as I'm sort of slumbering around on the top bunk in our back of the house bed bunk system, I hear my mother rattling around with her keys in the front door, and I hear my father sort of mumbling something less than amicable. And I hear my sister get up, and then suddenly my mom busts open the door to our bedroom and starts talking, and we had gotten a call from the police. We lived in an Nikiski-type area, which is about 8 miles outside town, and one of the things about this area is that it was densely populated with cows. One of the things about cows in northern Arizona is, I don't know if any of you guys have ever seen what is a cattle grate. Cattle are apparently afraid of walking across grates, and so they install them all along the road in this Nikiski-type north road to keep the cattle in these confined areas. We lived in a valley that was overlooked by a mountain, lots of cows, and cow grates work fine. So apparently what we patched together later from the police was that the horses, led in a Pinky in the Brains type format, had figured out how to get the latch off of one of our two gates that led down to this main road. Cowboy, of course, I'm sure thought this was brilliant fun, because he was the brains of the outfit, as you can probably guess. And Sox, the amicable Pinky type character that was a beautiful 16-hand quarter horse with nice, skinny, beautiful sorrel legs, followed along very cheerfully. They did not know about the cattle grate. And the police were called when one of the neighbors, driving along our road at 3 a.m, found a horse with all four legs plunged down into the cattle grate. You can guess which one of them it is. Cowboy, of course, is having a grand old time playing with the cows across the road. Sox is in deep trouble inside this cattle grate, and if you've ever had a horse, you know their first advice when a horse gets injured is shoot it. My parents were not thrilled about this. Didn't have a gun, didn't want to shoot a horse anyway. But wonderful, dear, sweet Sox managed to get all four of his legs out of this cattle grate and limp his way down the road, heroically wandering home, and then took three cops to go get Cowboy. We had to put Sox in a boarding house, and they told us to give him shock therapy, and they told us to bathe his legs in this horrible, sticky, carrot-colored stuff called betadine for about a year on end. Moral of the story of that there is that we did not get our trail ride. So we bathed his legs and we bound him in vet wrap, and Sox was a long-suffering, wonderful human being. We occasionally had to pull him out of the paddock and leave Cowboy by himself, and, you know, being Pinky in the brain, Cowboy would attempt to break into the yard as we were doing this and cause trouble, and pull the gate open and all of that. So eventually we got very inventive and MacGyver-ish with a set of chains trying to keep Cowboy in the paddock. So about a year passes. I'm about 14 at this point. We are ready. We are ready to go for our trail ride. It is finally happening. It is Christmas Eve, and Christmas Eve in Arizona is a beautiful time. And we saddled up. I wised up. I thought I was an old hand at horses at this point. And so we took off. My father was on an ER shift, which he's always gone for like 36 hours. So it's me and my mother and my sister, and we take off into this huge 40,000-acre ranch that is empty land behind our property. And things are going well for about the first 15 minutes. Then Cowboy figured out she doesn't know what she's doing. And there's a lot of land out here. If you've ever been to northern Arizona, you realize that it looks kind of like bushy. There's not very many trees, but there's a lot of big bushes. And so, Cowboy had also figured out that I had not been paying that much attention when I saddled him. And so we turn around one of these areas, and suddenly Cowboy's like, "Well, let's canter." I'm like, "All right, I can handle cantering," which is about the third fastest gait. And Sox starts to canter because he's following the leader, and we're having a good time. Then Cowboy's like, "Let's gallop." And I'm like, "Let's not." And Cowboy, of course, is 1,600 pounds, and I'm 14. And so they take off cantering, and then they break into a gallop, and we're dashing through trees, and it looks a little bit like running through a city, like while being Spider-Man. It's pretty difficult. And so at this time, my sister pulled the brilliant move of an anchorman and just jetpacking off of her horse because she realized she was out of control, and she's safely in the bushes. Sox is following along like a blind Pinky and having a great time. I am not smart, because if you know me, I'm more determined than I am smart. And Cowboy had figured me out, and he figured out that my saddle was about 65 degrees at this point, so he's going to turn it into 45 degrees. And then he's going to find a bush, and he's going to rub me off on said bush. And I'm on the ground, happily now, not on the horse anymore. Then Cowboy makes a full circle around said bush, tramples on me, leaves me with a permanent scar, and then heads back toward the fences with Sox. Then my sister and I, you know, sort of weeping self-pitifully, managed to haul ourselves off the ground and realize we have a long way to walk home, which was really only about a half a mile. Where did we find the horses but sort of gloating at the gate? Because they realized they couldn't get through this gate. So we had to, not only was it adding insult to injury that they'd kicked us off on our one trail ride, we had them by the lead horses and we didn't even dare to mount again, so we had to sinfully walk our horses home, both sort of weeping and sad and bruised, and turn in back in the yard, and our mother had said, "Merry Christmas, what happened?" So after this point, we were both a little bit too afraid to ride the horses on our own, and so we stuck to the paddock and we stuck to the corral until life just got a hold of us, got too busy to handle the horses anymore. And so my parents started to try to figure out some sort of solution. The solution was that we were going to be good citizens and donate the horses to a cause that was going to get better use out of them than we would. And there was a local group called Horses with Heart that uses horses to conduct therapy with disabled children. And you can guess how this went. Sox, the wonderful animal that he was, with his scarred up legs and his beautiful story about how he survived and no one said he would survive, formed this deep, meaningful bond with an autistic boy that had never spoken before, and apparently they had such a strong bond that this boy actually spoke and was able to go attend school and form this very meaningful relationship with his parents. And Sox, as far as I know, might actually still be alive. Cowboy was put into a paddock with the donkey. Moral of the story is that don't go into something expecting it to be wonderful when you don't realize how much work it's going to be. Thank you.
Kat Sorensen to the stage, please. Kat lives in the basement of an Airbnb in Soldotna, works at also the Clarion, and has a tattoo or three that her mom regrets.
Okay, so I've been near, heard, or in the presence of my father three times when he's cried. The first was in 2008, whenever Obama got inaugurated. We're laying on the couch, for some reason I'm not at school, and one solitary tear falls down his eye, and that has nothing to do with this story, but it's really poetic and I want you all to know about it. The third time was about 2 weeks ago when he calls me from the side of the Garden State Parkway in tears and says, "Kat, how do I make Tom Petty stop playing on the radio? I'm not gonna be able to get home if I hear Free Falling one more time." And like, "Dad, you just gotta turn the Pandora station off. You're fine." And then the second time he called me, and it didn't start out with him sad, and it wasn't a big thing at the time. I thought it was just another conversation. But by the end of it, he was in tears. And by the end of it, I realized that my dad was the coolest guy in rehab. So, I'm a senior in college, and I just turned 21, and I love drinking. And I get a call from my mom, and she's like, "Kat, your father's in the hospital. I don't think he's gonna be fine, but I don't think he's like great." I'm like, "Okay, well, like, let me know what happens." The next day, I call her. I'm like, "Mom, should I come home and visit? Like, is Dad okay? Is he still in the hospital?" He's like, "Yeah, he just has a drinking problem. They're sending him to rehab." I'm like, "Okay, Ma. Great, should I come home?" He's like, "No, it's gonna be okay." And I'm finishing up my senior year of college, and I'm trying my best to be a loving daughter, and I'm calling him and texting him every day. And my dad has this wonderful job with the state where he could be a functioning alcoholic for 15 years, but then they paid for 3 weeks of him going to rehab scotch-free. So he's in a rehab in northern New Jersey in Newark, which is very eerily similar to The Wire. Like, if you've ever watched that show, it's just a really bad place to be. And he's calling me every day, and we're talking, we're having a really great time, and just catching up, and me just really, like, connecting to him on, like, that emotional, like, AA level that I don't really want to get into right now. But then he asks me, "Kat, how do I get extra lives on Candy Crush?" And I tell him, "Dad, you just gotta change the time zone and you get all the lives you want." He calls me the next day, he's like, "Kat, everybody here, I'm beating them all at Candy Crush, I'm doing so great." I'm like, "Awesome." He's like, "But I let them in on your secret so everybody else knows too." I'm like, "Oh, that's fine, like, it's not that big of a deal. I read it on Reddit. It's an internet thing, everybody's doing it. Everybody loves Candy Crush." So that's step one to being the most popular guy in rehab. Know all the cheat codes to the games. Step two, my brother smuggled him in a harmonica, and my dad is not musically inclined. His brother is the one that got all the musical talent. My uncle's in a local blues band and great at music. My dad, he's okay. He just really likes to be the center of attention. So my brother goes up and visits him, and my brother is more like my uncle and has this long flowing hair, and my dad tells me later that when Arna walks into the rehab, everybody's like, "Is that your son? He's so cool." I'm like, "Yeah, my brother's cool, whatever." So my brother gives him a harmonica. He's like, "Here, Dad, you know, rehab's kind of like prison. You might want to play the harmonica a little bit." And step two to becoming the most popular person in rehab, play the harmonica. Everybody loved it. He would call me, he's like, what songs do you know that have harmonica in it? And I'm like, basically the entirety of The Last Waltz, like you could just play that album on repeat. So that's what he did. He would just play The Last Waltz on his phone with the Pandora app that I downloaded him and play the harmonica to it, and everybody loved it. Step three to becoming the most popular person in rehab: have a very loving wife who wants to make sure that while you overcome the most impacting, influential addiction, you still have access to your other one. My mom would smuggle in 2 to 3 cartons of Marlboro Lights every time she goes to visit. And my dad doesn't smoke that many Marlboro Lights, but what he was doing was giving them out to all of his friends. Buying friendships, step three. Making sure that everybody loves you because you supply them with cigarettes. And so let's recap. Step one, cheat codes. Step two, music. Step three, cigarettes. And that's how you become the coolest person in rehab. So towards the end of my dad's stint there, I can really just tell it's the best thing he's ever done in his entire life. He was always the cool dad to me outside of rehab. He was always the number one coolest person in my world, but he had this problem that he struggled with. And throughout that life, I always supported him, and I was an angsty 16-year-old, and I hated him, and then I became an angsty 21-year-old, and my dad went to rehab, and I was super excited that he did that. So he calls me one day, packing up his stuff, getting ready to leave, and he said, I actually had a reasonably good time in rehab. I'm like, why? He's like, because I was the coolest person there. I'm like, yeah, you were. You got a lot going for you. And he told me, yes, but the only reason that I had that was because I didn't let it go on long enough to lose you guys. And as he was sitting in the rehab day in, day out, and all these different meetings, what he realized and what I guess my family realized was he got to be the coolest person in the rehab because we were still standing right there next to him. Everyone else in that Newark rehab had gone through 3-4 times, struggled with all of their addictions, and came out on the other side alone and continuing with their struggle. But my dad did it one time, he did it well, and we were right there to support him every step of the way, and he's still the coolest guy ever, he's just not in rehab anymore. Thanks.
Wow, thank you both. And we get to hear their words in the paper, but boy, to hear you guys you ladies both share your stories live, what a gift, especially for me since I work with you sometimes through the school district. So, well done. So, look at all of you around here tonight. Like, we've got a pretty packed house, and this has been a gnarly, crazy week, and I was really looking forward to tonight, and I've got a big smile on my face, and all of the everything we won't talk about in this room that we say doesn't get to come through the door really didn't come through the door, and how nice to just be here and appreciating our community, right? So our last storyteller tonight is someone who we all know. We know her through her writing, through the Readout Reporter, and her excellent reporting that is factual and humorous. We know her through her work now when we hear her voice, and she's speaking on KDLL and helping bring great stories alive in our community through the radio. And who knows what her next venture will be. We've seen her in print, we've heard her on the air, and Jenny's going to talk to us tonight, and aren't we blessed?
My dad's cooking could best be described as unintentionally creative. He gets points for enthusiasm. He would regularly make meals that could feed families twice our size. He has high marks for resourcefulness. He was a master at using up the kind of questionable ingredients left in the refrigerator. Dad, it's fuzzy. Just eat around that part. Where he really excelled was his marketing. When I was a kid, he used to make this thing that he would take a can of stewed tomatoes and heat it up and pour in a little milk and then stir in slices of generic brand white bread until it was pretty much lumpy, pinkish spackle. Voila! Tomato surprise! The surprising part being that he thought anyone would actually want to eat that. Where he lost the judges was with his accuracy. As it turns out, 60 plus years around boat engines is not great for your hearing. Also, taking a fish hook to the eye, ripping it out, slapping a fish rag on it, driving your boat by yourself hours to the nearest port before you can be flown out for treatment, not great for your vision. Who knew? So being mostly deaf and pretty much blind is a bit of a handicap in the kitchen. Cooking shows, though, are great for inspiration. Dad, though, couldn't always quite hear exactly what they were doing, so when it came time to recreate the recipes, he knew that they had some kind of a red powder, but whether it was paprika or cayenne, kind of a toss-up. Yellowy substances, lemon zest, or mustard? Who knew? And of course, any white granular substance, you of course run the risk of sugar or salt. Like, you just never knew which way to go on that one. Cookbooks posed a slightly different risk because he, of course, couldn't read real well. He did okay with glasses, but being a commercial fisherman, that meant that all of his glasses were either chipped or scratched or dented or bent or busted or drowned or, in one notable occurrence, incinerated. And it's kind of hard to cook when you have to use one hand to constantly hold your glasses on your face. So his solution was to just read the recipe all the way through once and then just figure, okay, I got that. And the ingredients would turn out pretty much right that way, but the ratios would be a little off. So is it 1 teaspoon of salt or 1 tablespoon of salt? Is it 3/4 of a teaspoon of vinegar or 3/4 of a cup of vinegar? The surprising part was most of what he made actually turned out fine to really rather good. And on the occasions that it was somewhat less than fine, he always deemed it a success because success to him was edible by his definition. Shut up, it's fine, just eat it. But my nose hairs just melted, Dad. I'll make tomato surprise, okay. Really good. Baking, though, was a totally different deal. So if cooking is the equivalent of those third grade homemade volcano science projects, then baking is neuroscience. Baking is precision. Baking is perfection. And Dad, according to his own standard, never obtained this perfection. Everybody else could think it was the most wonderful thing in the world, and he would always find something wrong with it. The apples were too tart, or they weren't tart enough. The dough rose too much, or it didn't rise enough. The pie crust wasn't flaky enough, or it was too flaky. Like, that is even a thing, Dad, really? The irony was he loved baking. That was his hobby, that was his thing. He would do it every day if my mom allowed him, which she finally put her foot down because she did not have the self-control to live with a baker every day of her life. But he thoroughly enjoyed it, and yet he never felt satisfied with what he made, except for one time. I was home visiting on the 4th of July, and I woke up to the aroma of a holiday. It was earthy and buttery and vanilla and warm spices, and it smelled just like Thanksgiving, really, which was a little weird because it was the 4th of July. So I go into the kitchen, and sure enough, there's Dad taking a pumpkin pie out of the oven on the 4th of July. Something I should clarify about my dad, even though his list of medical conditions was quite lengthy, dementia was never on there. But he did have a habit of doing things that other people thought were a little odd. And if you asked him, he usually had some kind of reason for why he did it, and he always did it intentionally. Dad was never crazy, he just was never conventional. So I asked him, "Dad, did you just make a pumpkin pie on the 4th of July?"
"Yeah."
"Why?" "Well, they're good, aren't they?" "Well, yeah, I mean, I can't really argue with that. Pumpkin pie is really rather delicious." "Well, then why the hell not?" "Okay, the man has a point." So we take said pumpkin pie to the extended family gathering that night. And as usual with his baked goods, everybody ate it, everybody enjoyed it, everybody raved about it, everybody attempted to tell him how good it was, fully expecting to hear how it was not. And yet, he put down his fork and he leaned back and he declared for the whole world to hear, "That is the best pumpkin pie I have ever made. That is perfect." And I said, "Wow, 74 years of bacon. It's good you finally nailed that one, Dad, up high. All right." It turned out, however, that his success was short-lived. When we took him to the hospital that night, none of us were thinking about the pie anymore. And when he died the next morning, of course, what you're thinking is, it's not fair. It's not time. He wasn't ready. So when I got home that morning and I saw the last piece of pumpkin pie still sitting on the counter, I thought, you know, my unconventional dad, who has always done whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted it, maybe he was ready. And maybe the rest of us just need to accept that and move on. And I think that is easier when you have learned something from the person that you miss, when they leave you with some kind of wisdom that makes the rest of your life a little better. So from my dad, I learned to do something you love every day, because you don't know when it's going to be your last. And he also left me a killer pumpkin pie recipe. And I don't care what any of you think, he would have found that funny.
Story. Dang. I think you wrote that in your car right now. Am I allowed to say that? Yeah, she's amazing. All right, so now's the time where you turn to your neighbor and you practice, all of you, to be the storytellers for next time. The theme is lighten up, stories of escaping the dark, and go. Preferably someone that you, I mean, you could sit like with your table, maybe you don't know someone, like find someone from another table. Lighten up. Stories of escaping the dark. Just run with it.